So right now, there's no other theory that can tell us whether AI systems have consciousness or not. I know that I don't know what would happen if I were to press the button.
Don't press it, man. Don't press it.
This is Brain Inspired.
Hello, good people. This is Paul Middlebrooks. I mentioned last episode, and I'll mention it again, you can now support the show on Patreon. You can access it through my website, braininspired.co, or go directly to patreon.com/braininspired. There are two levels that you can sign up for, either $2 or $4 per month, which works out to about 50 cents or $1 per episode, respectively. I don't plan to run ads, so your support is much appreciated. A few people have signed up already, and I can tell you I feel deep gratitude to you guys, so thank you. So the other night, I was laying awake in bed, thinking of you guys and how to improve the show, and I thought, hey, wouldn't it be great if in every show I included a joke about neuroscience or AI, a joke of the week, if you will? So I searched for jokes of that ilk, and lo and behold, I found basically nothing. So I thought up a few jokes myself, and against my better judgment, here is today's joke of the show. So there's this kid, Jimmy, and he really wants to go play soccer, but none of his friends are available, and he thinks, oh, I'll just teach my robot here, Samantha, how to play, and then we can play together. So Samantha and Jimmy go to the soccer field, and Jimmy says, here, Samantha, let me show you how to kick the ball. And he steps back, and he winds up, and he kicks the ball. And Samantha says, oh, that's great. Could you just show me 1 million other examples at a million different other angles, and then I'll be able to play? Hey, Al, where's that rim shot? Thank you. Okay, yeah, against my better judgment, like I said. I'd love to hear your best neuroscience or AI jokes. Send them to paul@braininspired.co, or you can tweet to me. I am @pgmid. And believe me, I do have other jokes. That one was just the one that elicited the tiniest snicker from my wife. So send them to me, please. Okay, one last piece of business here. I will reiterate again, I really want to get more women on the show. It's not for lack of trying. I've been rejected multiple times, which is a familiar theme in my life. If you have suggestions for women that you would like to hear speak, I do have a few lined up, but they're in the future. So, send your suggestions to paul@braininspired.co, please. Okay. I may be a poor judge of jokes and a poor writer of jokes, but I am an excellent judge of character and an excellent judge, as you know, of podcast guests. Today's guest is Ryota Kanai, and man oh man, I hope you guys are ready for this. Ryota founded and runs a company called Araya. We talk about Araya and how it morphed from a company that uses AI to analyze human brain imaging, to a company trying to understand how AI works and how the functions of consciousness work. So he has two goals here. One is to implement the functions of consciousness, and we discuss some of those functions and how this approach differs from implementing the subjective phenomenal aspect of consciousness usually associated with the term. And his second goal is to figure out how to measure whether a given system has consciousness. And to do this, Ryota, for now, is working with the only game in town, something called Integrated Information Theory, or IIT, which is an approach developed by Giulio Tenoni, and in which you calculate a number, phi, that is a measure of the degree of consciousness of a system. We also talk about the historical course of how people have studied consciousness, the possibility that general AI may actually require consciousness, which I believe is different than the standard take. We talk about reinforcement learning in general, and then how he and his team have implemented curiosity and empowerment in a reinforcement learning AI agent, so it would be intrinsically motivated to explore and exploit its environment. He also shares how his thinking about consciousness has morphed over time. He's gone through three phases thus far, and plenty more. Without further ado, please enjoy our conversation. Ryota Kanai, thank you for being on the podcast and welcome.
My pleasure.
So you have a background in brain imaging and brain stimulation and studying our visual system and perception and time perception. And most recently, you were in 2015, you founded and you're the CEO of Araya Inc. And you guys have a team of about 26, last I looked, if I mm-hmm. counted, and with three advisors. And, mm-hmm. and it seems like you're putting out just shy of 2 million papers per year these days. So Araya does a variety of things. And all of these things, when you read the mission, is to transform information to create value for society. But do you want to tell me a little bit more about the company?
Yeah, sure. So as you mentioned, my background is neuroscience and I was doing neuroimaging. So initially when I founded this company, our focus was to combine machine learning and neuroimaging. And so before I founded this company, I was working at the University of Sussex in UK. But then I realized in Japan, there's a lot of health checkup that involves neuroimaging. So I wanted to access that huge data so that we can create value, especially like in prediction of like our future neurological disease and things like that. But then we shifted our focus more towards AI. Yeah, the part of the reason is my like real interest is in consciousness. So I did research into the visual system and time perception in humans because I wanted to understand how the brain generates consciousness. And since we also had expertise in application of AI, so we wanted to also try to understand consciousness in AI because we are very limited in terms of actual measurement technology in neuroscience. So if we use fMRI, we can only look at the whole brain, but with a very poor resolution, or we can look at single neurons, but then we can't see the whole brain. Mm-hmm. So if we use AI, we can see all the units and all the connectivity. So then we thought perhaps we can start from understanding how AI works to understand potential functions of consciousness. So that's how we shifted our focus in the company. But at the same time, we are a for-profit company, so we also deal with many commercial projects, and especially in collaboration with major companies in Japan.
Great. So, I should say that I'm speaking to you right now. The company is based in Tokyo, and you're in Tokyo. It's 10 a.m. there. It's 7 p.m. here. So I got out of putting my kids to bed. So this is great for me. Thank you.
Good time.
Yeah. So like you said, one of the goals is to create artificial consciousness. And mm-hmm. You've been interested in consciousness for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a lot to talk about. You're the first person where we're really going to focus on consciousness and the only person where we're going to talk about creating artificial consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So Richard Feynman, the great physicist and teacher and thinker, mm-hmm. His last words were, "This dying is boring," and to his sister. And that has nothing to do with what we're about to talk about. But he did have some things left on his blackboard as well. And one of the last written statements that was on his blackboard when he died was, "What I cannot create, I do not understand."
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's a great segue into talking about this. So in your words, what's the goal here, and how do you define consciousness for this purpose?
Yeah, I'm also familiar with this quote, and that's basically our spirit in trying to create consciousness. Yeah, although like we are a for-profit company, we have a deep interest in understanding what consciousness is. And in the past 25 years or so, neuroscientists try to find neural correlates of consciousness. And actually, like, there have been a lot of progress, and it was very useful to try to find what kind of neural activities give rise to consciousness. And so in that sense, we have made a lot of progress. But probably the most important contribution from neuroscience of consciousness is to make consciousness research science. But on the other hand...
As opposed to philosophy, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So a lot of people have skepticism about the possibility of studying consciousness because, you know, sometimes it's associated with something spiritual, or some people say consciousness is not really defined. But once we start thinking about how to create consciousness, we have to take consciousness seriously and think about potential benefit of having consciousness, especially in the course of evolution. So, for some reason, evolution came up with consciousness, but current AI doesn't seem to have any subjective experience. Well, maybe we just don't know. But but there's something fundamentally missing in our knowledge, you know, about the relationship between intelligence and consciousness. So we are currently taking two approaches. So one is, as I said, we want to understand potential functions of consciousness and implement them to see whether we get any functional gain. On the other hand, we also need to test whether consciousness is present inside any AI systems. So basically, like, there are two goals. So one is to create consciousness through functional implementation, mm-hmm. and the other one is to prove consciousness in AI systems. So the second one is particularly difficult. So we are mainly working on the first one, but the second one is philosophically important. And I don't think it's an impossible problem.
I want to talk about both of those approaches. I'm just curious how people in different fields have reacted to, you know, your definitions of consciousness and your approaches, and just in general, your goal to create it. So you have, you know, philosophers, you have neuroscientists, you have AI people. I mean, has there been a lot of support, a lot of any outright hostility? You know, how's that gone from the different fields?
Okay. Yeah, it depends on the person I talk to. But my focus on the function of consciousness doesn't seem to be satisfying to many people, because people interested in consciousness want to understand the subjective nature of consciousness.
The magic,
Yeah, it's sometimes called qualia. So when we see some images, we have a particular experience generated internally. Like when we see the color of red, it feels like red. And so there's something like redness of red. But then people understand why, like, spiking of neurons give rise to that kind of particular sensation. But if I say, potential function of consciousness is to distinguish different images, or use that information for planning future action, then, it's a functional description, but doesn't really explain why subjective experience emerge. So in that sense, it's not satisfying. But on the other hand, AI researchers or roboticists often think consciousness is a trivial problem. So actually, a lot of people, including philosophers, have thought about potential functions of consciousness. So in that sense, what I'm claiming is not necessarily completely new. There are a lot of researchers who already worked on the concept of machine consciousness, especially in the context of engineering. But in the kind of mainstream consciousness researchers, most of the focus has been on the so-called phenomenal consciousness, which is a subjective aspect. But my belief is we should pay more attention to the so-called access consciousness, which is a functional aspect of consciousness. And because we tend to think it's an easy problem, but it's still quite difficult. And mainly the reason is a lot of cognitive functions are not well defined. So because we cannot directly access other people's experience, so we don't know whether other people feel red in the same way as I feel red. And so in that sense, the subjective aspect is not really reachable. But on the other hand, when we try to study consciousness in animals or babies, we make inferences about consciousness in other beings. Mm. And we do that through something we can objectively quantifiable or observable. For example, there's a philosophical position called higher order thought theory, mm-hmm. Which states that consciousness happens when the system has meta representation of sensory representation. In other words, it's some sort of metacognition. So we can talk about, or we can measure the ability of metacognition in like many different systems, including other people.
So we can just jump into it then, because metacognition, which is near and dear to my heart, I actually tried to study metacognition in monkeys in graduate school.
Mm. Oh, great.
Yeah. And, I just thought, like, what's the highest level cognitive process I can study in a monkey? And that's what I came up with. So anyway, that's one of the functions of consciousness you've kind of listed throughout things that I've read and seen in your talks. So that's a big one.
Yeah. So we always have to study consciousness through some function we can observe externally. And then that part is not even trivial. So my position is, before thinking about how to solve the hard problem, which is how subjective experiences are generated from physical brains, we need to really understand what consciousness is good for.
You know, it's interesting. A typical criticism might be that we don't even understand consciousness, so we can't build it, we can't generate it. And your response has been, exactly, we don't understand it, so we need to build it so that we can understand it. And you have this great article on, I guess it's called Nautilus. It's an online magazine.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to read the quote. The article is called "We Need Conscious Robots." And you say, "Debates on consciousness are often too philosophical and spin around in circles without producing tangible results. The small community of us who work on artificial consciousness aims to learn by doing." So I think that's a really good summary of what you're doing here. So we talked about metacognition, which is a representation of a representation of a sensory or motor representation. You want to just talk about some of the other functions of consciousness, potential functions?
Yeah. Okay. So in cognitive neuroscience, we have encountered many tasks where consciousness seems to be important. But based on those observations, what we are thinking about the potential functions of consciousness are the ability to generate information internally. In other words, we first need to gain the so-called internal models of the world and of the self, and then use the model to generate potentially counterfactual situations. So maybe this sounds like very complicated, but the idea is we have something like a simulator inside our mind, and then use that for thinking about what might happen when we were to make a particular action. So maybe the simplest thing is, I can imagine what I would see if I were to wave my hand in front of my eyes. But then I can imagine that kind of sensory information, even without actually executing the action.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a like really simple example, but I can also think about how to drive from one city to another city by mentally simulating what kind of route I'm going to take and so on. So that kind of mental simulation becomes possible once we can use our internal model for many different purposes. And this is particularly important when we consider the so-called artificial general intelligence. So the reason is, once we have a model, we can use that model for many different purposes. So when we have a mental map of our environment, then we can use the map to go to any place on the map. So that gives us some flexibility in terms of changing the goal. But then, we can also consider more abstract maps. So like, for example, like, you know, to solve some mathematical problems, we can think about like many different ways to approach that problem and then mentally simulate or actually execute calculation and so on. So, yeah, so having this kind of internal model or internal map is like, you know, particularly useful. And to my belief or my hypothesis is the function of consciousness is to use this kind of maps.
Yeah, it's interesting. When you just made me think of, you know, trying to solve hard problems, often you're working on them really consciously, let's say, focusing on them. And your map example made me think of this in a mathematical equation or something. Mm. And you're visualizing it and you can't, you beat your head up against the wall for half an hour and finally, or an hour, and finally you get up and you walk away and you don't think about it. And so your subconscious works on it, and then it pops into your mind all of a sudden. And what a beautiful model for that is just to have this internal generative model that's exploring all these spaces, and it's, you know, generating it, and then you can just let it go because it's generating it and passing that information on to your subconscious. Do you want me to just spend the rest of our interview just talking about potential scenarios for how this would work? It made me think of the interaction between conscious processes and subconscious processes, and the way that what you were just talking about could work in that fashion. But so, yeah, so I think that that's an interesting potential function of consciousness.
Yeah. But what's missing in my hypothesis is how to draw the boundary between conscious and unconscious processing.
Yeah.
So as you said, a lot of thinking happens without consciousness. So there's something automatic. So, for example, like in neuroscience, we know that not all the neural activities in the brain contribute to consciousness, but we only have access to a part of it. And yeah, so there's this like a huge problem, but it's a boundary problem. So how do we know which part of the brain activity contribute to consciousness, and you know, where the boundary is? So that's an unsolved problem, and also. When I talk about this information generation hypothesis, I don't have direct answer to this. So yeah, so it's in that sense, it's still work in progress. But I think we can get a lot of insights from another theory called integrated information theory, proposed by Giulio Tononi and his colleagues.
Yeah, well, you were talking about your two approaches, and one is to test whether something is conscious, and this is one that you use frequently, right? This is sort of the main theory that you utilize when you're trying to test this.
Yeah. So right now, this integrated information theory or IIT is the only theory that gives us a measure of whether some intelligent systems have consciousness or not, and nobody knows whether this theory is correct. And there has been very little attempt to test this theory because it's computationally very hard to actually measure the consciousness measure called phi.
So the integrated information theory, its metric is called phi. And I think that, is that the main criticism of the theory, is that mathematically it is either impossible or virtually impossible to solve it exactly?
Well, yeah, that's one of the criticisms. But my impression is that people, a lot of criticisms are not like really like based on good understanding of the theory. But I think the theory of consciousness needs to be applicable to any system, including AI. So right now, there's no other theory that can tell us whether AI systems have consciousness or not. So in that sense, IIT is the only theory that gives us some idea or gives us some concrete measure we can use to test consciousness in AI. But at the same time, it's all hypothetical. So we can measure phi of an AI and then claim, okay, this one has maybe the 10 bits of consciousness or something like that. Mm-hmm. But we also need to test whether the theory is correct or not based on empirical data. And people think it's impossible because it's computationally intractable. But we are also developing more practical measures of phi so that we can actually compute integrated information in the brain and in AI.
So like you said, I'm not really up to date with modern integrated information theory and calculating phi, but how many different versions are there?
Oh, there are many. So roughly speaking, there are three different versions of IIT. The first one is based on mutual information, and it doesn't assume any dynamics of the system. Hmm. And then the second one is similar to the first one, but then it included dynamics of the system. So, but it was a major change. And then the third one was a major update to the theory, and started to involve many new things like concepts and also the distinction between mechanism level and system level integration. So the theory got a lot more difficult. And I also heard they're working on a new version of IIT. So there will be the four different versions. And mainly we are currently working on IIT 2.0.
Okay.
And so we're trying to make IIT 2.0 computable. But some concepts we're developing are applicable to IIT 3.0. So we are making progress. And yeah, but I think although IIT started from the context of neuroscience of consciousness, but that information theory itself seems to be useful in characterizing many different complex systems.
Just giving them a number and with different degrees. Hmm.
Yeah, so in principle, we can compute consciousness of the internet
You had to go to say consciousness of the internet. Okay.
Yeah, so that kind of thing is in principle possible and interesting to think about.
Well, one of the consequences of sort of buying into IIT, integrated information theory, seems to be also buying into panpsychism. So panpsychism, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is the belief that consciousness is lies on a gradient and is present to some degree in all things. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And you're a panpsychist, is that right?
Yeah, I must agree. But I think panpsychism is a very natural philosophical position.
Yeah.
Because in terms of physical materials, there's nothing special about the brain. What's important is the way neurons are configured and wired together, which somehow generate consciousness. But the important thing is the information in the brain rather than how that information is supported by physical substrates. So in that sense, it's natural to believe that consciousness can be implemented into other non-organic materials. And in that sense, there's nothing special about the brain or biological systems, but the consciousness can happen in any material. So in that sense, I'm a panpsychist. But we need to identify the necessary and sufficient condition. And we also need to understand what it means to have information in a physical system.
Yeah. Just as an aside here, speaking of necessary and sufficient, more along the lines of sufficient, mm-hmm. I think I'd heard about this before, but I just recently heard about a case. It's been around for a while. There was a man who had hydrocephaly since his youth, and 90% of his brain was gone because of the condition. He's an adult, and he's fully functioning, fully mm-hmm. conscious. Mm-hmm. I don't know what his FI score is, but his IQ was low, but he got along socially and could get along in society just fine. Mm-hmm. And where is consciousness in the brain? What does that mean when 90% of it is missing? You know, so it's just interesting to think about. I don't know if you'd heard about him and or if you had thoughts about that.
Yeah, I think it's probably study by Marker. And so basically the patient had only the midbrain and without any neocortex.
There was no neocortex?
Well, I don't know the exact composition. There might be still some left, but the main point is there was very little brain preserved. So then this observation led some people to think that we may not need the cortex to have consciousness, and also like used as an argument for the potential presence of consciousness in insects.
And right.
Yeah. So in a way, like when we think about consciousness across many different species, maybe we shouldn't think that the neocortex is the only place where consciousness happens. We may have like many different levels of consciousness, and so. And a lot of times, like lower part of the brain, like brainstem, is like much more necessary to support consciousness. Or it may not contribute to the contents of consciousness, but
right.
And of course, when we think about a consciousness in flies, they don't have neocortex, but they have like very sophisticated systems. So
yeah, it's interesting to think about. Mm. Well. Okay, so most people, when they think of consciousness in AI, they think of first creating general AI and then either creating consciousness on top of that, or some people think that consciousness will just emerge, once mm-hmm. once we successfully implement general AI. So do you think we can have consciousness without general AI?
That's an interesting question. I guess the standard view is that we don't need consciousness to create general AI.
Right.
But I want to challenge this notion because, as I said, we have a functional gain from the ability to generate information internally, such as flexibility to change goals on the fly once we have internal models. So if my conjecture is correct and consciousness happens whenever some information is generated internally, then general intelligence may require that kind of function because it allows the agent to use the knowledge for like many different purposes. Hmm. So I see some potential commonalities between the ability to generate information and the ability to adapt to different goals flexibly in general AI. So maybe in that sense, consciousness is a requirement for general AI.
I hope we find out soon enough. If, in your broad estimation, how far along are you in your project here to replicate functions of consciousness in artificial systems and solving the ability to measure it? And how far along are you? And what is your outlook? When is it going to happen?
I hope it will happen soon. But I think what will happen. In reality, it will be a very slow progress. So maybe it may not be us, but some people may create consciousness without knowing that they actually created consciousness. But for example, like if we manage to create like very primitive level of consciousness, like maybe like insect level consciousness, we may not know whether it's like real consciousness or not. And I think. But at some point, people will start accepting consciousness in machines once they start interacting with autonomous robots. So, for example, like Sony has a pet robot called Aibo, which has the shape of a dog. And people already have a lot of attachment to that kind of robot agents. I guess they are still unconscious, but at some point, particularly like if they are like fully autonomous and use some sort of internal model of the environment and have the model of the agent itself, they will have like all the key functions of consciousness, and people will start feeling consciousness in those agents. So it's purely from like external viewpoint.
Yeah.
Yeah, so as I said, there are two aspects. One is to create consciousness, and the other one is to prove the existence of consciousness. But the second one is hard, and maybe it's more cultural, because it's very hard to get the exact answer whether like other animals or other people are conscious. Even for humans, it's right. really difficult to prove that other people have consciousness.
Yeah, yeah. As you're speaking, I was just imagining a future paper from you entitled stop swatting flies about how we've discovered consciousness in flies. Let's say we do. Let's say there's a measure we discover and we feel confident that there's a measure of consciousness in flies, let's say. Will we feel more guilty swatting them, for instance?
Well, probably not. I think some people already think other animals have consciousness, but we still eat them, right?
So, sure, yeah.
Yeah, so, but on the other hand, right now, people don't attribute consciousness to machines, but by some point, maybe we will start treating AIs as though they were animals.
Yeah, I think that'll come sooner rather than later, I think.
Yeah.
How about we spend a few minutes? So these have been pretty broad, and this has been really fun for me talking about the broad mm-hmm. topics of consciousness. You want to spend just a few minutes talking about one of your recent papers that's come out?
Mm-hmm.
So this paper is called A Unified Strategy for Implementing Curiosity and Empowerment-Driven Reinforcement Learning. So this is really, we're going to keep it high level, but this is the nuts and bolts mm-hmm. of what you're doing here.
Yep.
So we actually haven't talked about reinforcement learning much at all on the show. So, I mean, I hate to do this to you, but in the broadest terms, can you say what reinforcement learning is?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, reinforcement learning is a study of how to train an agent, it could be animal or AI, to learn how it should interact with the environment to maximize their achievement in certain goals.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, but most of the time, it's based on some rewards function given externally. So, for example, maybe the famous example is DeepMind's DQN, which solved many Atari games.
Right.
Yeah. So there, the goal is to maximize the scores, and so but we can use reinforcement learning to train an agent to maximize some scores or some gain in games or in reality.
Yeah. So, but recently, people have been training intrinsic motivation in these reinforcement learning agents. So, what does that mean? And what did you guys do in the paper here?
Yeah. So, intrinsic motivation is to have an internal reward rather than external reward to train agents. Yeah. So, in particular, we focus on information as motivation. So here we took two types of intrinsic motivation. So one is curiosity and the other one is empowerment.
Yeah.
So curiosity is very useful. Okay, maybe let me talk about current limitation of reinforcement learning first.
Please. Yep.
Yeah. So there are many limitations, but the main problem of reinforcement learning is that the agent tries all kind of things to get some point. And once it gets got the point, then it learns to repeat the actions that led to that reward.
Right.
But in reality, rewards are very rare and also delayed. So in a complex environment, it's very difficult to try everything out until you get the reward. So I don't think people would pay you to do all the random things. And
I don't know. I'm pretty good at it. I don't.
Yeah. Yeah. So in that sense, we needed to find more efficient way to train agents. So curiosity is one way to train agents when there aren't many rewards. And the way to do it is we use information gain as an intrinsic motivation. So, whenever you discover something new about the environment, or whenever you improve your internal model, you get the reward. So it's kind of similar to curiosity in humans. So when we encounter some situation where we don't have enough information, we want to gain. We want to understand the situation by gaining new information. So I don't know. It's hard to come up with a good example, but if there's some sort of mysterious button on the wall, so you want to push it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, that's curiosity. But also I think humans are strongly motivated by curiosity. So this says I have trouble like focusing on my work because like there are a lot of like interesting tweets and yeah, so like a lot of times like the titles of like news media make you curious and want to click. Yeah, so people are intrinsically motivated to gain new information. But in the same way, we can use this kind of incentive to train agents because that facilitates exploration of the environment, which is important. And once we have a good internal model, as I said, we can use the internal model to solve many different problems. So even when there's no clear definition of what the right thing to do, it's generally good to understand the current situation better so that we can use that understanding of the situation to solve problems that happen in the future. Mm-hmm. So that's a curiosity. And empowerment is a different kind of intrinsic motivation. So it's the incentive to maximize the possibility of your future. Yeah, so for example, like when you are in a room, you don't know where the like next position you have to be in the room. But in that situation, you want to be in the center of the room because you can reach anywhere very quickly. So it's kind of like, you want to be in a state or kind of well-prepared state where you can reach anywhere. But also maybe the reason why people want to have money is to maximize this empowerment. So when you have more money, you can use it for many different purposes. So that way you can maximize future possibilities. So that's a different kind of intrinsic motivation. But what's common between this is that these are not defined externally. But when there's no clear rewarding goals, it's beneficial for the agent to maximize these quantities. So in this paper, what we did was we formulated curiosity and empowerment in terms of information flow. So basically what we did was defined curiosity as information from information flow from the environment to the agent. So the agent wants to maximize the amount of information coming from the environment so it can learn more quickly. Mm-hmm. And then empowerment is the opposite information flow, so from the agent to the environment. So by maximizing this, what it means is that whenever agent takes an action, then the consequences are more predictable for the agent. It's a little bit like a complicated concept, yeah, but but the point is, by maximizing this information flow, the agent has more control over the environment.
Okay.
Yeah, so we unified these strategies in terms of information flow and implemented them into deep neural networks so that the agent can, so basically the model part is reinforcement of the deep learning.
It's deep learning with reinforcement learning rewards driving the learning process?
Yeah, exactly. So reinforcement learning has like many standard algorithms, and and we use like a standard reinforcement learning algorithm, but the reward came from information flow, like from outside to inside or from inside to outside.
Gotcha. So if the agent, this agent that had the two types of intrinsic motivation, if it were a human, would it be like someone who prefers learning things that are hard to learn or mastering skills that are difficult to master and yet obtaining as much money as possible through doing those things?
Yeah, exactly. Something like that. Yeah.
Okay.
And if AIs are motivated that way, I think they will become eventually very strong. And we are interested in intrinsic motivation because intrinsic motivation is a way to implement autonomy. So we want to have AI agents that find goals themselves without us telling them what to do. Mm-hmm. So I think that kind of autonomy is another interesting aspect of consciousness. And also to implement intrinsic motivation, the agent needs to have the ability to imagine what would happen in the future. For example, without the ability to evaluate its own prediction. So for example, about this mysterious button on the wall, I know that I don't know what would happen if I were to press that button.
Don't press it, man. Don't press it.
Yeah, okay. So that's kind of like a meta representation based on evaluation of an internal model.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, so that's the situation where information generation becomes relevant. Yeah, so this motivation is also related to works by Carl Friston, who proposes free energy principle, because he talks about minimizing uncertainty in the future through using internal models. So that he talks about counterfactual predictions and things like that. Yeah, so the motivation comes from the consideration of what the brain might be doing and how this ability to predict what might happen next seems to be highly important for the functional consciousness.
So I'm internally curious, and now I will externalize that curiosity. The terms that are being used, curiosity, empowerment, is this the Wild West of AI terminology? You know, are we going to, if I write a paper, can I make up a new term and ascribe it a function, an equation, and an optimization, but give it what's historically been kind of a human label, like curiosity and empowerment?
Well, there are many different terms for this.
I know there are a lot of standard terms already.
Yeah, but these are used. So, they're not something we just came up with.
Right, right. So this is interesting work. And I mean, I had to pick one paper to really talk about because you guys are working on so many different fronts all along these same lines. So it's really fascinating stuff. And I'll link to stuff in the show notes here. Let's see, did we miss anything on the paper?
Well, but we are not all completely satisfied with the paper because it was still very theoretical and just a presentation of the idea that we can formulate these things in terms of information flow,
right,
and possibly implement into neural networks. But to really prove the power of this approach, we want to also show this in a larger scale project. For example, implementing this into robot or drones so that we can observe the behavior of such agents in a more complex environment.
So do you guys have stuff like that in the pipeline, in the works?
Yeah, we recently got the grant to work on drones. And
cool.
So we want to create the curious drones. I don't know how to control them, but that would be interesting.
Don't press the button, Ryota. Don't press the button on the wall. Maybe you should press the button. I'm not sure yet. I'm not sure. Well, okay, so we have just a few more minutes left, and I appreciate you hanging on and being so generous with your time. But I have some more general questions, if you don't mind, and then we'll just wrap up.
Yep.
It seems to me in what I observed in my science career that the active practice of science seems to lead people over time to sort of start studying the lower level questions. You go in with a big question and then you realize we don't know the answer to that, and we also don't know the answer to the things that would support that function, and then you study lower and lower questions. And I'm curious how that was a goal of mine, was to try to stay as high level as possible. And I'm just wondering how you've managed to stay focused on the big question, consciousness.
I see. Well, it's been very difficult to focus on the big question because there are always low-hanging fruits.
Yeah.
And
resistance from colleagues as well, correct?
Yeah, that's true. So I have to confess that I also worked on many irrelevant projects. But whenever I divert from my original interest, I tend to get depressed and I get sick. And yeah, so I know I need to work on consciousness. But on the other hand, it's very frustrating frustrating that I cannot make much progress as much as I want. So I can claim that I'm interested in consciousness. We work on consciousness, but in reality, we are working on very small part of consciousness, and I wish I could make much more progress more quickly.
So your curiosity is going wild here, but your empowerment is not optimized. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I admire that you keep at it. And I mean, that's what I tried to do as well. So, of course, then I quit and moved into an RV. So it didn't work out for me. But okay, so I'm curious how your views on consciousness have changed since beginning to think about it. You know, I remember reading Neurophilosophy by Patricia Churchland and, you know, and coming at it from a philosophical standpoint and then getting interested in the neuroscience. And so you know, have you been steadfast throughout with the same view, or did you used to have a different view of consciousness?
Yeah, I think I changed my views on consciousness quite a lot. Maybe there are three different phases. Mm. So I got interested in consciousness because it's a big problem for science. I was reading Chalmers' Conscious Mind when I was an undergrad, and then I thought all the neuroscience is completely useless.
Yeah, right.
Nobody's really addressing the heart problem in consciousness. And yeah, but at the same time, like, you know, I think a lot of my colleagues working on neuroscience and consciousness are interested in the qualia problem. But then I encountered Tononi's integrated information theory, and I thought it gave us some remedy for the heart problem, but also it got me interested in information in physics, because if I take the theory seriously, any system that has integrated information could have consciousness.
Right.
But then I need to understand what information is in terms of physics. So that's an interesting area. So that was my kind of second stage. And I still retain that viewpoint. But more recent view I got was the importance of functions of consciousness. I think that has been kind of dismissed in the field. So, for example, I didn't like Daniel Dennett's position of consciousness, but now I quite like his what he calls the hard question of consciousness, which is the question of what you gain by having conscious perception. So the potential functional consequences of consciousness, which is not very well known. So in a way, to make more tangible progress in consciousness research, I feel like we need to really understand more functional side of consciousness. And so that's my current position. And I'm trying to work on it by trying to create consciousness in AI.
That's great. Okay. So you said you walked down a few different roads that didn't bear fruit. What's something that you either failed at or an idea that you were just wrong about, and how did it affect you moving forward? You have to choose one. For me, there are too many, so.
I wish I worked on animals as well, because initially, I took subjective experience maybe too seriously. So I started with human psychophysics.
Yeah.
But I think facts are very important, and we don't gain new facts by observing human behavior that much. Of course, that's important, but I think we need to do a lot more observation in the brain with more cutting edge technologies. So maybe in my career choice, I feel I should have studied animal consciousness, or maybe I can do that next, but I have to reach at least try to solve something in what I'm trying to do now. So maybe that's my next career.
I think you picked a good time to do it. I mean, my advice would just be to not do the animal research yourself, but have other people do it, because it takes so long.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
I mentioned earlier, and this is just kind of a fun question, but you kind of inspired me to think about working on a problem and then walking away from it, and then the solution comes to you later. So what's one way that when you're feeling stuck on a problem, how do you get unstuck? Do you have a method? Do you have any methods?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Yeah, I don't feel I get stuck often. Maybe to me, a bigger problem is to find time to continuously work on the problem. So, usually I don't get stuck, but maybe some projects have lower priority and I just can't find enough time to work on them.
Well, you're always getting interrupted by interviewers wanting to interview you. So, okay. So my last question here, Ryota, is how do you see red? No, I'm just kidding. I'm not going to say that. But
hard.
Yeah. Where should people find out more about what you do? You're on Twitter.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. You can find me on Twitter. That's Kanair, K-A-N-A-I-R. Yeah. You could also check our website. It's araya.org, where we put our publication list. So you can find some of the work we are working on. And yeah, like many of our members go to a conference called ASSC, which is Consciousness Conference, or you can just visit us in Tokyo.
Oh, God, that'd be great. Well, I really appreciate the time, Ryota, and thank you and much luck to you. This has been fun for me.
Yeah, thank you.